This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're on remote. Jeanne Dubreau is here. She has two new books, and today we're going to hear about both of them, and now we're going to hear an opening poem.
Hi, Grace. Thank you so much for having me. So I'm going to read the opening poem from one of my two new books, Wild Kingdom. This poem is called Syllabus for the Dark Ahead. Throughout this course, we'll study the American landscape of our yard, coiled line of the garden hose, muddy furrows in the grass, awaiting our analysis, what's called close reading of the ground. And somewhere, something will yip in pain, perhaps, a paw caught in a wire, or else the furred and oily yowl of appetite. And flickering beyond the fence, we'll see the slatted lives of strangers. The light above a neighbor's porch will be a test of how we tolerate the half illumination of uncertainty, a glow that's argument to shadow. Or if not that, we'll write an essay on the stutter of the bulb, the little glimmering that goes before the absolute of night.
The absolute of night. You can bring it home. Well, that is the poet in the backyard, right? That is definitely a poet in America, for sure. Nobody else would stand in that place and think those things but a poet. Jeanne Dubreau, tell us about the two new books in one year.
Well, sure. So actually, it originally wasn't supposed to be that way. But COVID has, as I think many writers know, delayed the release and production of many books. So initially, the first of these two books, Simple Machines, which is a collection of sonnets, was supposed to come out much earlier. And Simple Machines is a series of linked sonnets, including it contains what are known as heroic crowns, which are 15 sonnet sequences. So it contains four sonnet crowns and then a bunch of individual sonnets. And Simple Machines takes as its inspiration a little moment from the poet Jane Kenyon. So I have this epigraph at the beginning of the book, "Things simply lasting than failing to last." And so put simply, Simple Machines is a book about how things fall apart, whether it's friendships or romantic relationships or American democracy. And then the second of these two books, Wild Kingdom, is a book about my experiences of being in the wilds of academia. And so it uses as its setting academic spaces. But really, the book is a meditation on cruelty and power, so that often we think of academia as being this distant ivory tower sort of place. But in the book, I reframe it as a microcosm of the kinds of larger arguments and discussions we're having in society about gender and religion and sexuality. And so the book is largely about the ways in which institutions can use power for good or for ill.
Both of the book, well, they seem to be a continuous journey to me, actually. Of course, they are chronologically. But the one about academia is so interesting because of your intricacies. You are never head on. You inlay, you embed, you codify, you elegant. You do all of these things like stitches, which I find no other poet is doing, but we would love two poems in a row to get a real sense of you. I have to shout out that you have 9 books under your belt. Probably 9 more coming.
God willing. So here are two poems from Wild Kingdom. This first one is called Portrait of an Administrator with Strategic Plan and Office Supplies. To sit on her couch was to be silenced by upholstery, plush muffling of cushions from which it was difficult to rise. Arendt writes, in politics, obedience and support are the same. And for a time, I was obedient. My reports in ordered bullets, collaborations, programs, opportunities. The provost preferred speech contained, a line of staples in a box. I remember the fold between one week and the next. She said to me, "These people are unreasonable." She said, "These people are quite reasonable." Inside her office, everything was cream. She told me what I heard I hadn't heard. Our last meeting, like a memo full of typos, whited out, then shuffled through the copier machine. Language turned to shiny blurs. Arendt writes, "Most people will comply." For a time, it was easy to ignore the sharp wedge of the provost's hair. I should have seen she resembled more a letter opener on a desk, how like a knife the piece of metal looks. I told her what I heard I heard. I told her that my expertise was words. Arendt writes, "The holes of oblivion do not exist." A gifted bureaucrat, the provost taught me truth was thin as paper. The little circles she punched in it remain, and still I hold this punctured story to the light.
That is a masterwork. It is a laboratory for every workplace we've ever been in.
Well, and that's the thing, just because I was writing about academia, I think most people who have been part of institutional settings will recognize the way we're each forced to confront power and at times perhaps are gaslighted or told what we've heard we haven't heard. And of course, the Arendt that I'm referring to is Hannah Arendt, philosopher. And those are lines from her book on totalitarianism.
Well, that's one of your strengths, the way you weave in these other minds, you know, and speak to them.
Oh, thank you.
Have another poem.
So this next poem, there are a series of bird poems in the book, and they're most definitely inspired by Louise Glück's flower poems from Wild Iris. So these are all birds who are speaking about themselves, but also speaking about bureaucracy, too. So this poem is called Great Blue Heron. The bay is still for now, like a conference table, undisturbed, opaque surfaces. What meetings happen here? I forget the bureaucracy of seasons, inefficient changing of the leaves. I watch from across the water, the yellow light of morning switching on. In autumn, the sun sorts through foliage, a shuffling of papers on a desk, and the river is a muddied conversation. Leaf over leaf, the day does its work in the vacated offices where only eelgrass grows, green spools of tape, and wild rice like pencils stuck in the shallows. If I am migratory, I go to another cove like this. These days, I read the shoreline for the silver gleaming of ideas, precise and streaking thought of who I am.
Get a bit of geography in there, but the truth comes through. But isn't it true? I mean, have you ever been in any institution? I've been in the corporate world, I've been in television, and isn't it just truly a microcosm of ownership and power? I think there's a better word than power. Maybe it's holding the paper up to the light. Maybe that's a better word. But we navigate these. Some of us, I think it's important to write about it, though, because my daughters are all in the workplace and they don't know what to call it. You name it.
Well, and I think the word for me that hovered above the book as I was writing the collection was cruelty, we all have the opportunity to do right by one another. So why is it so often that people choose the other option, which is to do harm to other people?
This is why I say your poems have a conscience.
Oh, thank you.
And there is a morality to writing. There is a morality to writing. And please, we'll go further with that. I have to say something every interviewer has said to you, but you were born in Italy. Your parents were American diplomats. You did live in Zaire, Poland, Austria, Yugoslavia, let me see, Belgium, America, of course, nothing left for you but Texas. But what we know in your previous books that you speak of this life and refer to it, but how did it make you? How did it make you, the writer, the tone of you? What did that amalgam do to create Jean Dubreuil?
Well, I know that American diplomacy has lost some of its luster these days. But what I learned watching my parents in the Foreign Service was, one, they really believed in diplomacy, particularly as an alternative to war, and that diplomacy was about open communication, ideally, and cultural exchange. My father worked for the now defunct agency, USIA, the United States Information Agency, which was largely devoted to cultural exchange and also the support of free press. And so watching the ways in which my father, when we were overseas, was engaging with artists and other kinds of makers and helping them to find opportunities to often come to the United States to work on their art further was really important to me. One, because I realized how much artists matter. You know, in many cases, we were in countries where if you wrote the wrong kind of poem, you could potentially go to jail for it. And seeing that firsthand made me realize these things really do matter. You know, I think when you're a poet in America, it's easy to think that what you're doing is completely unimportant because poetry isn't as central to the American identity as it was, say, to Polish identity. You know, living in Poland for all of those years, it was clear to me that every Pole in some way thought about poetry, even if they weren't particularly literary. And that was because Poland's national poet, the romantic poet Adam Mickiewicz, was a physical presence in every town in Poland. You can't go to a town in Poland without finding a street or a square or a building named after this poet, Adam Mickiewicz, who wrote Poland's great national epic poem, Pan Tadeusz, which is a poem that sort of narrates and defines Polish national identity. So, you know, living in a place like that, you very quickly realize that the arts matter, that they're crucial to how people see themselves, and that in many cases they have the power to change politics.
And that is why you are a poet of conscience. It is from those experiences. Please, Jean Dubreuil, give us another poem. She's received about a dozen national awards, so go ahead.
So this is a more explicitly political poem that makes the connection between the small world of academia and the larger national stage. And I think most people hearing it will recognize the famous scene that we all observed on TV. So this poem is called After Crying. For years on the college honor board, I asked about the body and its boundaries. Who owns that place? Who enters it? And then the respondent, as he was called, would arrange his mouth into a room of grief. On the TV, a woman is remembering a hand across her face. She thought that he might kill her accidentally. Indelible, she says, in the hippocampus is the laughter. The past is a hallway that the mind cannot escape. For years on the honor board, I spoke with men. They talked about themselves as boys with names like Matt or Brett, who held their power casually in the same easy way they might have carried cans of beer through a party. A man is weeping on the screen today. Even now, he's secure in his confidence, like one of those homes on a sheltered street where the trees go on for miles. On the honor board, I saw how we judge the worth of lamentation, the men with their shuttered eyes, their bodies unbreachable. We place their tears in bright decanters on a mantelpiece. We spill the tears of women in the garden to water the silky roses and the vines.
Give us the last four lines again. You had me at the decanter. Give us those lines again. Tears in the decanter.
Sure. So this is about the tears of men versus the tears of women. We place their tears in bright decanters on a mantelpiece. We spill the tears of women in the garden to water the silky roses and the vines.
There could be a course taught on those four lines, don't you think? And what would that course be about, John?
I think it's about the way that we weigh men's pain more heavily than we weigh the pain of women. You know,
because
I think
it's so rare to see.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. So women's pain is so common and so frequent that it therefore is undervalued.
Please give us another poem from this book. It has a definite continuity. Each poem is so very individual in form and tone and word choice, but it is there's one silver thread going through it all.
Yeah, I mean, the book is very much concerned with my interest in a kind of extreme form of bullying known as mobbing. Mm-hmm. And mobbing is a kind of group bullying in which the person who's identified as the target is basically, the point is to demolish or annihilate this person. And once you've been through mobbing, you recognize it everywhere. So this next poem is most definitely based on a true experience. When I resigned my position at my last academic institution, the day I did it, I had laryngitis. And so it was a day where I felt really powerful and at the same time completely stripped of my voice. So this poem is called Fairy Tale with Laryngitis and Resignation Letter. You remember the mermaid makes a deal. Her tongue evicted from her throat and moving is a knife cut with every step. This is what escape from water means. Dear colleagues, you write, for weeks I've been typing this letter in the bright kingdom of my imagination. Your body is a ship of pain. Pleasure is when you climb the rocks and watch the moonlight touching everywhere you want to go, a silver world called far away. Dear colleagues, you write, this place is a few sentences contained by the cursor's rippling barrier. What happened here is only beaks and brackets, the serif's liquid stroke. The old story has witches, a prince in love with the surging silence of women, a knife that turns the water red. You write, dear colleagues, now these years are filed in the infinite oceans of bureaucracy. Everything bleaches or fades. In other words, goodbye. Sometimes it's possible to walk, although you've been told inside the oyster shell of your heart, there is no soul. Creatures like you must end as a spray of salt, green droplets floating breathless in the air.
Whoa, it was worth waiting for that voice. I like the way you leap into fantasy, because first of all, that's a safe place to speak. And next of all, you have all this power, you know, all this magical power. You could just throw water on them and make them dissolve. So I thought fantasy and fairy tale was a really nice way to frame that poem, which is fairy tales are pretty scary.
They are. And I mean, Hans Christian Andersen, most of the time.
Yeah, this is about life and death.
Yeah.
The spirit.
The spirit. Yeah.
And you're fighting for your spirit in this entire book. And do you think you left with it and maintained it?
I did. I mean, I think that I would never call my writing therapeutic, but there is real value to having to put one's experiences into the constraints of a poem. It forces you to achieve some distance and think so critically about craft decisions that it becomes easier not to wallow in sadness or pain. And so for me, these poems, as difficult as they were to write, were also really helpful for creating emotional and intellectual distance.
Well, you use form to control what you feel. And therefore, that compression makes it all the more intense. But for you, that is definitely, craft is very important to you. And it is the way you, it's your thrust. It's your thrust. So let's hear another poem before we go into your academic years.
Sure. So this is another poem that uses a different kind of received storytelling to navigate pain. It's called Memory of a Year with Allusions to the Greeks. Mm. When I had company, it might have been the classicist who sat with me. He would have called that year Cloud Cuckoo Land. We worked in a place of claw and pinion, beak. Outside, a shadow bird was cawing on the branch, all signs gesturing at catastrophe. Some ancient playwright said, grief's an avalanche whose weight we cannot stop. Of course, I'm paraphrasing here. We rolled boulders to a hilltop. We commiserated in the maze of our small suffering. The Greeks would have named the classicist kind-natured. He told me once he hated how that year had smashed the clay of him, breathed anger in his lungs. Beyond my window, the great green lawn remained indifferent, and in warmer months, students drowsed on towels, golden figures in the light. And then, sudden as a crane that lowers gods onto the stage, the classicist and I were both leaving, a strange departure from the mythology. We were leaving even the monster of that year, the many-headed one, so hungry it would feed upon its own serrated self. I don't remember our goodbye. I hope somewhere he's still explaining what the Greeks believed about pain, how the body keeps on bleeding and we spit the poison out. That snake-bitten year, I'll strike it in revenge for how it wounded us. I'll string the bow. I'll send the arrow through a dozen iron rings.
But you know, the interesting thing is if I asked someone who read the book what it was about, they would not say suffering. They would not say suffering. What comes forth is really sparkle.
Oh, that's
the words. It's very, there's a lot of beauty. I mean, say it clearly and make it beautiful, right? But I mean, what you get is this beautiful interfacing of imagery and emotion, but you don't say this is a poem, this is a book about pain. That's not the first thing it's about. It's funny. It's very strange, isn't it? But back to you, back to your life. You got your MFA at Maryland. Then you went to the University of Nebraska to get your PhD. Now you're getting an MFA from Vermont in nonfiction, as if there's anything left to learn. But I want to, before all that, St. John's College of Great Books. How did that shape your little brain?
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, I think that's, for me, why the Greeks are so important. They're a touchstone in so many of my books for so many different reasons. I think because I was so shaped by examinations of war and politics and justice that we see, you know, in the epic poems, but also in the plays, and they continue to be an influence on me. So, for instance, when I write about my military marriage, for 20 years, my husband was a career military officer. You know, the Iliad and the Odyssey, and also the Aeneid, are such important texts for me because they really create the foundation of how we think about and how we romanticize war. When, you know, in this book, I was really interested in how many of the myths are about cruelty and suffering, and the way that suffering is transformed, often physically, through a kind of physical metamorphosis in Greek myth. So the Greeks, for me, just remain central to my thinking.
Well, we'll have to share this program with St. John's. They will like that. I have an ad hoc group of Johnnies that I teach poetry because the college itself does not offer poetry.
That's right.
So
that's
I have them as a private group. They are the best I have ever had. And I've taught for 60 years. They are the best in the world. I adore them. They come in, you know, well, we won't be able to describe to the audience all the facets of that St. John's atmosphere, but it is based on the classics, and we'll just leave it there for people to imagine what it could be. I do want to hear another poem, and then I want to talk about Corona.
Sure. So I'll read the closing poem in Wild Kingdom. And it's actually the first poem I wrote in the book. It was the first poem I wrote when I moved to Texas. And I fell in love with these birds that are everywhere here in North Texas called grackles. Mm. And you see grackles in very unsexy sorts of places like parking lots and in front of grocery stores. They're these incredibly resourceful, smart birds. And I think I fell in love with them because they struck me as a figure of resilience. And because they managed to make do with the small garbage that you see in a place like a parking lot. And but I thought
people do not love them.
No, I might be unusual. I just think they're beautiful, fascinating, rambunctious birds. So this is called Song for a Grackle in the Kroger Parking Lot. Don't hate the scavenger. In daylight, it's purple stained, iridescence of oil spilled on asphalt, its body like a rag wrung out. Love instead that groups are known as plagues, annoyances. Love the reflective eye that stares, how everywhere is home. Time has a way of driving over us. Love the choice the grackle makes to tear the silver insides of a candy wrapper, to pick apart the leavings, to sing and sing despite the rusted metal of its throat.
There you go, vindication. Vindication. I do want now to move to A Crown of Sonnets for us to tell us what it is, what it took, how long it took, what was comfortable about it, and what was challenging.
Sure. So A Simple Machines has these small individual sonnets interspersed between what are known as crowns or heroic crowns of sonnets. And a heroic crown is a sequence of 15 linked sonnets where the end of the first sonnet, that last line, becomes the first line of the next sonnet and so on, so that the first 14 sonnets are all linked in this kind of sequential way. And then the 15th sonnet is all the first lines of the preceding 14 sonnets in the arrangement of those lines. So you can read the 15th poem and have a sense of how each of the preceding sonnets began. And they're also rhymed and metrical. So
Did you love it?
I love the kind of puzzle pieces of working in traditional forms. Mm-hmm. I wrote Simple Machines in about 6 weeks. And then it took me a long time to revise the book. I was teaching a class in form and theory to my grad students, and the class was going very badly. And I thought, have I forgotten how to do this? What is it that I'm not doing successfully to convey the pleasure and joy of working in tradition? And as a way of reminding myself that I still had some sense of how to do this work, I started writing the crowns. And the trick to writing a heroic crown is you actually write the last poem first, the last sonnet first, and then you basically got the outline for the whole sequence.
Does everyone do that?
I don't know, but it's how I do it. And it also, I think, helps to have a literary conceit, a dominant metaphor that you in some way explore different facets of as you're working through the crown.
Easy for you to say.
So, for instance, one of the crowns in here is about replaying the 2016 election results over and over in the speaker's mind. And so I use the metaphor of math throughout that sequence to try to make sense of these election results.
Mm-hmm. Give us two together, though, so we can see the linking, right?
Sure, I can absolutely do that. Let's look at...
So we can see how the last line of the one sonnet will be carried over to the first line of the second sonnet?
Yeah, so I'll read the first two sonnets from the sequence that's titled Irrational Numbers. And Irrational Numbers is about replaying the election results over and over again in the speaker's mind. So this is Irrational Numbers. The news performs its algebra of grief. And every day a pundit says we're near to something like a crisis. We feel relief we haven't struck it yet. The target clear, the distances decreasing week by week, as in the story of an arrow shot and time divided into points, the streak of motion stopped, not moving where it's not or where it is. The news is paradox. A paper ballot falling into space will make no sound. 1,000 votes are rocks when they're dropped. If only we could place the facts which slip away ad infinitum, the totals coming in are not a sum. And then here comes the next sonnet. The totals coming in are not a sum of our America, or so we tell ourselves. What wide divisions we've become. We think about our lives in parallel, how people are arranged like iron rails that face, remaining equidistant, straight across a plain. We share the same travails, the burden of a train, its speed and weight. Only at the horizon might we meet, a far away that's always out of reach. Despite the rift, our tracks are incomplete without the other there, each needing each. And through the bolted steel of this motif, we make sense of our infinite disbelief.
Whoa, that thing is a singing rock. a rock that sings. Well, before we could have a final poem, what do you think is the one thing that your students would say about you?
Probably that I'm tough. Yeah, that I have really high standards and that I'm sort of actually famously tough as a teacher, that I'm known for being rigorous. But I think that's okay.
You're the one they will remember. You are the one they will remember. Yes. Let us have a final poem.
Okay, so I'll read you just the opening sonnet from Simple Machines, which is a standalone sonnet. It's not linked to others. It's called Wireless Doorbell. What makes it chime when no one's waiting there? The porch is emptiness, the cul-de-sac, a concrete narrative that circles back upon itself, each house a questionnaire left blank. Our street has nothing to declare. Somewhere a fan whirs on, a Cadillac sits idling, and a window lets a crack of light across the lawn. The peephole stare is wide, revealing nothing there. What makes the doorbell chime? A switch? A wire crossed? A ghost? We make a story from the sound without a maker. Perhaps it's our mistakes that visit us, the envelopes we lost, the keys, the little griefs we buried in the ground.
The voice of Jean Dubrow, and this is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making this program possible. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions, post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. Our funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Foundry and also Avideh Shoshani and the Sinibit Fund. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and our engineer is Mike Turpin.